Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Anytime you try to boil down something as complicated as a war, even as complicated as an individual person like Smedley Butler, into a single explanation, you're always going to trip over yourself.
Today's episode is based on a very true fact. Despite all the urges not to read the comments, if you consistently reply with one phrase, if you consistently email us one phrase, if you argue with us in the comments, by us, I mean mostly me, in the comments, eventually we'll have to do an episode on a topic. That topic is General Smedley Butler. You may have heard his name in reference to a really great episode we did around the war in Afghanistan with General Dan Bolger, actually our biggest ever episode of all time. People were bringing up an idea of War is a Racket, which is based off of a pamphlet that Smedley Butler wrote as a post-retirement Marine Corps general in the 1930s, which is based on the idea that will resonate with a lot of you, that effectively war, corruption, profiteering drove a lot of really bad decisions in U.S. foreign policy history and draw a lot of decisions today. People are bringing up War is a Racket in the context of the war in Afghanistan. Now, while sorry, I'll let you speak to this in a second, but I think while we're both sympathetic to critiques of the war in Iraq, critiques of the war in Afghanistan, as the author of this book, Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire, will point out, Smedley Butler's thought is a little simple, it's a little oversimplified, and it's a little misused. So it's useful to have a really interesting author come on to talk about it and its themes.
Yeah, that's what I loved about Jonathan, is that he even was willing to say, look, yeah, like Smedley's analysis was not 100% on. It's kind of taken a life of its own in the year 2022. Here's what the context of what he was actually saying was, which is actually very useful. And by the way, not enough people actually do know about a lot of these wars, about the deployments to China of the Boxer Rebellion, around U.S. deployments in Haiti. They may not even know what the USS Maine is or the U.S. occupation of the Philippines. There's a convenient reason why we don't talk about this, because it was not a great time in U.S. history, but it's still important. And to use that as the heuristic from where Smedley Butler was coming from, then reckon with the legacy of his idea of his book and more, I think is very useful. So I think people will enjoy and get a lot out of this, especially in the context of any current modern event where we're arguing for war or not. And I think you'll enjoy it.
And look, the real thing here is, like, we obviously have people who are critical of our coverage of an issue like China. And I think it's really important that we have guests like Jonathan on. Like, Jonathan is like, he kind of like implies that the U.S. wasn't the good guy in the Civil War, which was like an interesting take. So like, we're definitely going to
I was wondering what he said. I didn't press him on
that.
Yeah,
but like we're going to have like, we're going to have like people who are on the left who aren't going to agree with us on this topic. And I also make clear that we are definitely the only China hawks who will have a conversation about racism in Haiti and the Philippines during the 1920s. So it's good that we could do that. It's actually a very important episode. We would do that. Also want to call out, Jonathan has a really interesting podcast that we are putting out in the blog. It's tied to his actual newsletter. His book is going over all these different like cultural artifacts. So what he's doing is he's interviewing guests and talking about these various points of U.S. history through the lens of a cultural artifact. So he does an episode on Guantanamo Bay with Spencer Ackerman, who came on this podcast last August to talk about the war on terror, through the lens of Harold and Kumar escape from Guantanamo Bay, a very specific artifact of 2000s culture, which almost certainly has not aged well. So I definitely want to go check that out.
Yes.
A lot of great stuff here. Okay, quick things. We're going to do the roundup of everything you need to check out. Have been loving the tipping function, not just from a sense of like, hey, it's cool to get a bit of monetization on the podcast after waiting 2.5 years, but also just the fact that it's cool when people send it when they actually like the episode. So if you like this episode, if you liked the YouTube video, if you liked a newsletter, send us a tip. It is a cool feature, and it just kind of gamifies us trying to put out the best content we can here as we scale up this year. Two, Substack is coming out on Thursday, so definitely go check that out as well too. You can subscribe in the link. Finally, Bookshop. This is a book show a lot of the time, so Gangsters of Capitalism is available there. Definitely go check it out. Lincoln Network, thank you for supporting our work. Let's get into the episode. Jonathan Katz, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to see you, Jonathan.
Nice to see you.
We do a lot of book episodes, everybody, and I have to say that for a book about a historical topic slash figure, Jonathan does a really excellent job of unironically melding the past with the present day dynamics. Sometimes you'll read a history book and there'll be an implication or a subtle hint that something that's happening in the 1890s relates to today, but you actually do a great job of counterimposing the in-person and the past. So I hope during our interview we could capture that, because it's actually what made the book really, really enjoyable on my end. It doesn't always happen when you're reviewing a book, but let's just start here with why we really wanted to speak with you. Listeners to our episodes around the withdrawal from Kabul and Afghanistan really heard us talk a bit about this idea of war as a racket, an idea which I think is a really interesting idea, but it's actually one I disagree with. But in the name of all good faith, I'd love to have you, Jonathan, explain war as a racket, the idea, the pamphlet, within the context of Smedley Butler, the Marine who your book focuses on.
Sure. So Smedley Butler, as you note, was a Marine. He joined the Marine Corps in 1898 to fight against Spain and Cuba. And then he basically served in every U.S. invasion, occupation, conquest that happened from 1898 until really his retirement in 1931. And then he spent the last 10 years of his life basically campaigning against war, against imperialism. And as you note, in 1935, he wrote, he actually kind of summarized the speech that he had been giving, called War as a Racket. And then he followed that up with a series of articles that are sometimes mistaken as having been from War as a Racket, but were actually much more sort of confessional and critical of himself. And in War as a Racket, he is essentially, and that period of his life, he's essentially making the argument that, and it's not a very subtle argument, and it's not a scholarly argument. Like he was a Marine, he didn't go to college, and he's talking in a popular argot to the masses, mm-hmm. But the argument that he's making is basically two parts. The first part, and this is really what's contained in the book War as a Racket, is that there's essentially what ends up being dubbed by Dwight Eisenhower's speechwriters a couple decades later as the military-industrial complex. So essentially, his argument is that you have industries, especially the arms industry, especially the munitions industry, in his telling, who kind of force the United States into wars, convince politicians to back wars, to invade other countries, in order to boost their bottom line. In the next part of that argument that he was making in these articles, he wrote them primarily in a magazine called Common Sense. He was saying, and he was basically borrowing a metaphor from Prohibition. He had spent a couple of years, he had taken 2 years leave of absence from the Marine Corps actually to run the police department in the city of Philadelphia, which was his hometown. And he had been fighting against the racketeers, against the mob, the bootleggers. And he's taking that metaphor and he's saying that you've got the big bosses, you've got, the brain guys, you've got the finger men who are telling, where to attack. And then you've got the soldiers. And he was saying, I was a soldier. And he makes this famous confession where he talks about, all the things that he had done to Latin America, to Asia, to China, and says, I was a racketeer. I was a racketeer for capitalism.
And what I love about the way you sum that up, and I immediately started thinking about, is my critique of Butler is he confuses, or his popular model is conflating, two very different types of wars and the dynamics in them. So as you're mm-hmm. discussing here, the wars, and we'll go into these specific wars you're talking about, and you travel through these small, not in human terms, not in moral terms, but small interventions, mm-hmm. gunboat diplomacy, invasions of Haiti, interventions in the Philippines, the Boxer Rebellion. those type of wars in Yuriri chart are wars where often you do see moneyed interests engaged and involved. My objection is, and why I think in the 1930s, his ideology, despite the fact that he was an anti-fascist person, ended up unhelpfully framing. So for example, let me put it this way. I think the argument that war is a racket ended up creating a false vision of why World War One happened, which ended up enabling the worst version of isolationism in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to say, hey, like a sugar plantation or a sugar interest has an interest in Latin American interventions. And it's another thing to say, hey, like let's not engage in Europe in the 1930s because this big bad arms industry forced us into World War One. So can you like reflect on that part a bit? Is that a fair, I think, segmentation of those two parts of the argument?
I mean, to a certain extent, I'm partially I'm trying to answer this, you know, as myself, and I'm also trying to sort of explain how Smedley Butler looked at that question, because those are two different things. Butler was making a very simplistic argument, and he was making an argument from the perspective of somebody who had been, you know, a frontline soldier in all of these wars. And you know, he was somebody who had joined the Marines at the age of 16 during a huge propaganda run up to war against the Spanish, and what's often known as the Spanish-American War, or the Spanish-Cuban-American War, or the Spanish-Cuban-Filipino-American War, depending on who you're asking. He felt that he had been, to a certain extent, duped. Maybe he even would have acknowledged that he was willingly duped. But he felt that he had gone to war to defend democracy, to, in his words, free little Cuba. You know, and the Spanish were doing horrible things in Cuba. They invented concentration camps there. They were you know, killing civilians. And he felt that he had gone to war to, you know, defend a democracy against an empire, and then ended up just sort of, you know, creating an empire. And I think that, you know, his answer to that question is that it can be very hard to tell which kind of war you're in until you're in it, and really until you look at it in retrospect. So World War II is a big deal. I don't know how to put it other than that. Like, and it occupies so much of our imagination, you know, the imagination of everybody who lived through it, and everybody since. When we think of war, you know, that's oftentimes the war that we think of. And there's a new book out called, you know, I believe it's called In Search of the Good War, which is sort of about the propaganda surrounding World War II and after the fact, you know, trying to make sense of this like horrible event that we were in, right? And World War II is a very complicated war. It's a little too simplistic to say, you know, that we just went to war to, it's way too simplistic to say we just went to war to fight fascism in Europe. That would have been a great reason for a war. I'd be totally into that, right? What Butler was arguing about in the 1930s was he saw this coming confrontation, not so much with Europe, not so much with Nazi Germany and Italy, but with Japan, because he had spent, you know, all the things that he was doing were really, to a certain extent, based around the Pacific and the United States' control of and colonization of the Pacific. Even the things that were happening in Latin America, even the things that were happening in the Caribbean, a lot of that had to do with the Panama Canal. Butler was part of the Marines that essentially helped sever the state of Panama from Colombia for the purpose of building the canal and then protecting the sea lanes to the Panama Canal. All of this was, you know, to the colonization of the Philippines, and all of it was ultimately to, you know, expand US markets into China, where Butler also invaded twice. As a Marine, first as a junior officer, and then as a general in the 1920s. And he saw, in China, both times, he was essentially allied with Japan and the European powers. And particularly in the 1920s, he saw this coming confrontation with Japan. He saw that, you know, the United States is an empire, the Japanese are an empire, we're both grabbing land, were both grabbing possessions in the Pacific, and that this was going to create a great power struggle over the control of China, over the control of the Philippines, over Hawaii, and he saw, you know, this is going to drag us into a war. And he has, a phrase that he uses in some of the things that he's writing after Wars of Racket, like in like 38, 39, where he says, you know, we'll be dragged into a war before we know what it's about. And I think that, you know, again, I'm not a Japanese imperial apologist. I'm not trying to say that Japan good, United States bad. That's not at all the argument that I'm making. But I am saying that, you know, and maybe this is like, you know, other than that, and this is Lincoln's sort of argument, but taking Nazi Germany out of the war and looking at what actually does get us into World War II, right? Because Japan attacks Pearl Harbor and on that same day attacks the U.S. colony in the Philippines, attacks the U.S. colony in Guam, attacks the British colonies in Malaya and Singapore. And it's that conflict. That conflict looks a lot more like World War I. That conflict becomes much more sort of two great powers for, you know, venal and also self-protective, but not necessarily like ideological reasons, going into a bloody struggle with one another. And the last thing I would say about that is, you know, I think that, so Butler did not identify with, you know, the America Firsters in the late 1930s and especially, well, the early 1940s, because he died in 1940. You know, he was not on the team of Charles Lindbergh or, you know, Father Coughlin. Mm-hmm. He one of the things that's hard to say is what he would have done if he had lived even a couple years longer, because he dies the same day the French signed the terms of surrender with the Germans. Wow. In 1940, and then 18 months before Pearl Harbor. And all of his children go fight in the war. A destroyer is named for Butler, and it participates in both the invasions of Sicily and D-Day. And then ultimately, maybe ironically, a Marine base camp is named for Butler on the island of Okinawa mm-hmm. after the war. You know, we don't know what he would have thought. I do know that Smedley's wife, Ethel Butler, Bunny, as he called her, she's actually approached by like a peace committee, like essentially, you know, a committee that's trying to keep the United States from getting involved in the war. And they want to run an excerpt of War is a Racket. And Ethel says, no, she says, we're at war right now. She's basically like, call me when the war's over. And then maybe we'll try to prevent the next one. So I don't know. I mean, my guess is if he had been alive, when Pearl Harbor happened, he died pretty young. He died at 58. That, you know, he may have reenlisted at that point.
That's fascinating.
But it's really hard to say.
That's a very interesting kind of history. You know, talking about it from the Japanese perspective is very useful too. The best professor I had in graduate school, I actually did national security at Georgetown, which was, you know, interesting for a variety of reasons. But he made us and challenged us to think about World War II and the beginnings from the Japanese perspective. He's like, look, they see what is happening in Cuba. They see what's happening in the Philippines, in the early 1900s. They see become an industrial power by copying the West. It makes sense to copy the Western military strategy. And then run for the empires and all of that. The Germans and everybody collapses, which leaves you a lot of territory. And then the U.S. just cuts off your oil supply, which is an existential threat. Right. So he's like, well, you know, from that perspective, bombing and preemptive war kind of makes sense. I never thought about it that way. And it was very interesting in order to at least try and do so. He actually forced us to write an entire essay for that. It's always stuck with me ever since. So what do you think there about what Smedley Butler got right? what he got wrong, and his legacy kind of in our politics today of the year 2022?
That's really quick. Good questions. What did he get right? I think so. You know, his ultimate answer, don't do war. Mm-hmm. And that war is not, and war is not noble necessarily. Right. And that war is not, you know, simply saying, you know, I am going, you know, just to serve my country does not necessarily mean that you are serving the interests of most people in your country.
Yes.
And you are doing that at the cost of the people in the countries that you're invading. I think it's clear. I think I make the argument explicitly at some point, or at least implicitly, that, you know, the wars of the early 21st century, like Afghanistan, like Iraq, like, you know, Syria and Somalia and Libya and all of the forever wars that, you know, in many cases are actually still happening, really resemble much more the wars that Butler fought in the early 20th century than anything else. And that really, yeah, one of the things that, you know, that really comes out when you study this, and that really was made clear to me in, you know, when I was doing research for Gangsters, was that, like, it's really, those are really the kinds of wars that the United States has historically fought, you know, sort of big, you know, good versus evil conflicts, like World War II in Europe for sure. Maybe some people will disagree with me on this, but I think, like, you know, the Civil War ended up being, you know, I don't know if the United States was good in that, but, like, the Confederacy was definitely evil. So there was that. But, you know, most of our wars are much messier, grosser affairs. And, you know, he realized it way too late. I mean, he, you know, I think this comes across in the book. Like, he was an ass. Like, he did some horrible things to a lot of people. And his fellow Marines did so as well. And he wasn't really speaking out against them at the time. It's only sort of at the end, when he goes on these speaking tours and he's trying to, you know, frankly, he's kind of grifting, like, he's trying to make money to, like, you know, pay for his house, you know, in the middle of the Great Depression. And he goes on these speaking tours and he's really sort of, I may even say this in the book, like, he's basically a poster, right? Like, cause he realizes that, like, going on the speaking tour and saying, like, the most attention getting thing that you can then gets you more invitations to give more talks. And it's only in doing that that he really realizes how little Americans know about what's being done in their name. I think that's good, and having done those things is bad. I think that, you know, more broadly, you know, he has a lot of blind spots. Race is a big one. He is less racist than some of his fellow, you know, just overtly white supremacist Marines, which is not necessarily saying much. You know, his mentor for most of his time in the Corps is a guy named Littleton Waller, Tazewell Waller, of the Waller and Tazewell families of Virginia, whose family had, among other things, his ancestor was the enslaver of Toby Waller, who Alex Haley identifies in Roots as Kunta Kinte. Wow. These were Waller's living that. I mean, he's just out there being like, let's just kill these N-words. Like, mm-hmm. and Butler is like a little subtler, although not much. In some ways, you know, he ends up being more destructive because his ability to, you know, for instance, see Black people in Haiti as people then leads him to, you know, more effective methods of control. But he's really blinded to that. He develops a sort of class analysis later in his life, but it's not very subtle. And it's not very well thought out. It's just sort of like, all of this is being done, you know, the elites, they're just, you know, taking advantage of us. And it just leaves out the agency of, you know, people in the working and middle classes who, you know, who go along with these things and sometimes, you know, lead them because, you know, for whatever reason, they agree with them or they think they're good for them. So I think he got, I think, you know, he had a lot of blind spots. He got a lot of things wrong, but, you know, and by the way, I mean, I would say, you know, going back to like your original point, mm-hmm. you know, when people say, you know, read War is a Racket, it will teach you everything you need to know. I'm kind of like, not really.
This is basically, this is all I needed you to say okay. to feel good. Cause this is why this started. Mm. Looking at the war, there's, and we'll get into the war in Afghanistan, but yeah. War is a Racket basically explains nothing causal about the war in Afghanistan. And that is my problem. Because I like the way you framed it, and Sagar, you set this up with, what is the lesson from Smedley Butler? The lesson I'm taking here mm-hmm. is, wow, like wars of territorial acquisition and imperialism are bad. Mm-hmm. This idea that countries should take other countries' land and make it their land is bad. That is not a good thing. It's very important to note here, there's a reason why most people don't know the history of U.S. intervention in a country like the Philippines, not merely because it's not covered in history, because it's unsuccessful. It only lasts for 45 years.
Well, I mean, that's pretty successful in its own right.
What I more mean here is that mm-hmm. the American attempted empire is just a total catastrophic failure by the standard of thinking like, hey, like the British were able to maintain an empire for hundreds of years. Like, I think mm-hmm. something you really capture that's interesting here, and the race factor is interesting. Because like, to be very clear here, like this isn't just, because we have like a 50-50 split audience here, this isn't just like us scoring woke points. The Filipinos, they had representation in Congress. There are delegates. They weren't voting.
They didn't have voting. I mean,
my point is they were that. All I'm saying is they were that tied into the U.S. And what I basically mean is the reason why they never become a new state is just like literally because of racism.
Yes.
So that's what I'm really getting at here. Like the reason why America isn't actually able to integrate this thing into itself is like actual, like literal racism.
Yeah, we were too. I mean, this is just, it's just true. And you can just go through the congressional record in the debates that are happening and, you know, look at the Insular Cases, which is the nickname for the series of rulings by the Supreme Court that basically decided that Filipinos, Puerto Ricans, I mean, those rulings are still in effect today in Puerto Rico, in Guam, in the Virgin Islands, in the Northern Marianas Islands, where, you know, basically they just decided like, we're too racist. Like these people will just never be white. They'll never understand Anglo-Saxon principles. And so they just don't deserve, self-government. It's really shocking. I mean, you talk about, people in Congress at that time, like one of just like the all time assholes in American history is a guy named Ben Tillman, Pitchfork Ben. Mm-hmm. He was a one-eyed. That's not what made it evil, but it just sort of adds to the character. He had joined the Confederacy. He remained sort of like an unreconstructed, literally neo-Confederate who played a leading role in drafting the Jim Crow Constitution in South Carolina, bragged on the Senate floor, basically about like the disenfranchisement of Black people, the denial of education, and oversaw like a huge, you know, wave of lynchings as governor of South Carolina, and then he's in Congress while this decision is being made to annex the Philippines. And he's saying like, no, if we annex the Philippines, if we make it a state, then all of these non-white people, and he lists them all like in like, just like the most, you know, racist terms that you could get away with on the Senate floor in I guess, 1899. And he's just like, you know, we can't do that. Then all these Filipinos will come here. And it ends up sort of being a compromise between people who are so racist that they're not even willing to like annex the Philippines. And like, you know, the Teddy Roosevelt crew, who are also like, white people are the best and white people should inherit the world. But it's our duty to like teach these people by killing them. You know, the benefits of civilization is essentially like the compromise between those factions, that ends up, you know, creating the Insular Acts and this sort of weird, you know, one of the ways it's often put
in
is that,
out, you know,
yeah. But one of the ways it's often put is that the Constitution does not necessarily follow the flag.
And here's the question,
which
I always want to get to whenever we recount America's sordid history in these areas. Mm-hmm. What do we do with this now? So you cover China. We talk about China. It's in the book. You know, you're looking at the Boxer Rebellion and, you know, like literally dividing China up. Mm-hmm. When the CCP looks at their relationship to the world today, mm-hmm. they look back at that century of humiliation and say, hey, look, that was the worst thing ever. You go into the fact that very prominent names in American history, Forbes Carey, mm-hmm. Delano Roosevelt are descended from families that literally spread opium. It's as if the, you know, leading families in China in 2100 were the people who literally like made all of their riches off of the opioid epidemic in terms of like sheer death and destruction. Like that would be the proper metaphor here. But at the same time, the CCP abuses this history to say, hey, all these bad things happened, therefore we're going to take over Taiwan. You can't say no. So my question basically is how can we have this be a useful conversation? So how do we acknowledge history, but then also recognize that the three of us, A, like I'm like a black Jew, like Sagar's like an Indian second generation immigrant. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to guess like your background, but like we weren't responsible on several different levels for any of these decisions. So I don't feel as if I should be constrained in how I look at a question like Taiwan or Hong Kong by my metaphorical ancestors' poor choices. So how do you think of this dynamic?
So yeah, you're asking a lot there. I would say a couple of things. First of all, and China is a great example. They use this history. They use it in their propaganda. You know, I spent a month in China reporting this book and spent, you know, much more time than that, you know, researching this history and the ways the history is used. And they use it. And when they are talking about the United States in 2022, the assumption of their that they're using and the assumption that they know that their audience in China is bringing to the table are these memories of and cultivated memories of these humiliations and these abuses. And, you know, so the first thing is, you know, and I say this in the book, not even knowing the history just seeds the conversation to, you know, the worst malefactors. You know, like these things happened. They happened. I you know, my you know, I read my book. It's got, you know, I forget, it's like 50 pages of like of footnotes or of endnotes, which was severely reduced at the insistence of my publisher from like the actual length of that thing. It is you know, I back everything up. I'm not none of this is hearsay, except for where I'm like, you know, quoting a source, and I'm like, mm-hmm. then you can look back at that original source and figure it out yourself. But you know, these things happened and, you know, Americans were in many cases bragging about them at the time, and not knowing them just makes it so we can't even participate in the conversation. It puts us at, you know, I mean, just to, you know, put a nationalist spin on it, it puts us at a disadvantage. In the Philippines, where I also spent time, you know, researching the book, and there's, you know, two chapters about China and three chapters about the Philippines in there, Rodrigo Duterte, the authoritarian president of the Philippines, he uses the U.S. history of exploitation and war and, you know, sort of in some concentration camps, torture, you know, in some cases sort of low-level genocide in the Philippines as a way to reposition himself away from the United States and toward China. Again, you know,
and a key thing, because we haven't discussed the Philippines before, Rodrigo, like sometimes I realize there's debates around illiberalism and liberalism and all of this. Like Rodrigo Duterte is a bad dude. Like this isn't even really an ideological debate when it comes to assessing whether or not this is a person who should be respected on the international stage. Like, he brags about like killing people. You want to talk like drug war, like there's like insane, like extrajudicial, like literal murders of literal drugs. So I just want to like make a clear like editorial point.
When I was there, and it's still going on, but I was there, you know, during the so-called, what is officially or not is what's known as the war on drugs. But it's really a war in which, the state and sort of allied, you know, gangs are, you know, killing the poor and just murdering people and just leaving their bodies in the slums. And there were you know, these things called, I worked with a fixer, you know, Filipino journalist who sort of acted as a translator and, you know, helped me figure out where to go, because I'd never been to the Philippines before. And I didn't speak any of the 100 or so languages that are spoken in the Philippines, literally 100, I think. She would talk about, you know, the night shift, where, you know, they would get called out to a quote crime scene, which was inevitably a place where the police had killed somebody. And then set it up and been like, who knows who did this? And then, like, you know, we're basically saying to journalists, like, you know, who did this? We did this, like, be afraid of us. Yeah. And Duterte, you know, he uses that for his own power, and the Chinese government uses that for their own power. So one thing that I would say is, like, you know, knowledge is power. Like, if you, like, not even knowing these things happened, where does that leave you? Like, how do you even then participate in the conversation? You just look dumb and you don't even know where people are coming from. Right. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, like, in terms of my background, you know, at the moment that most of these things were happening, you know, my family was in Russia, you know, being pogromed out, they were emigrating to the United States, you know, essentially as, you know, refugees from anti-Semitism and political violence and economic violence. And so, yeah, like, I don't have any ancestors who were, you know, in the Marines with Butler.
Your college tuition wasn't covered by what happened here, is what you're describing.
Exactly. But I am an American, right? And I live here now, and I benefit from, you know, I benefit in many cases from the things that were either set up in that time or the things that came out of that time, right? I mean, you know, so much, like, you know, this is another place where, you know, Butler gets it right. He doesn't get it right, like, in like the subtlest way. But, you know, he understands that, you know, these things were done for profit, you know, to a certain extent profiting the elites, but also, like, it just brought lucre. It just brought, you know, cheap commodities to America. I mean, you know, in the Banana Wars, as they were known, which Butler fought in, like, those were about, first of all, bananas, which were not widely available in the United States before that. And they just sort of, you know, allowed, you know, big companies like, what's now, you know, Chiquita International, then United Fruit, to just sort of open up, you know, big plantations where, you know, peasant workers were harvesting bananas and selling them here. He participates in the invasion of Mexico in 1914, which was done at the behest of the oil companies. I mean, literally, William F. Buckley Sr., the lawyer for the oil companies, writes the Wilson administration and is like, there's a revolution going on in Mexico. We need a U.S. invasion in order to protect Texaco and Standard Oil. And
for the audience here, the William F. Buckley references to William F. Buckley Jr., who is effectively the intellectual father of the modern conservative. Wow, American history is a very small club. That's the takeaway from this conversation.
And you're not in it, as George Carlin always said.
I'm just thinking, it's fascinating, as you said, about the legacy of Smedley. He was right, but he also gave a heuristic which is a bit too simplistic for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And as this is what Marshall alluded to, you could say war is a racket And people would assume that that's the reason we invaded Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not. You could say that that's the reason we stayed in Afghanistan for so long. But those are two different arguments. Mm-hmm. So what frustrates you most about the deploying of war as a racket in contemporary political conversation?
So, okay. So war as a racket itself, I don't spend a ton of time on it in Gangsters. But I did spend a fair, it's not a long book. So I spent a fair amount of time, going through it and actually sort of like did with a researcher kind of did like our own kind of fact check on it. I include one error, just glaring error in my book, that's in War as a Racket. He makes a statement that prohibiting U.S. warships from traveling more than 200 miles off the U.S. coast would have prevented the USS Maine from going to Havana in 1898, which is immediately disproven by the fact that Havana is 90 miles from the U.S. Yeah. So like that doesn't work. More broadly, he makes this argument. There was an argument. He wasn't the only one making it at the time. That essentially, the munitions industry had gotten us into World War I. And there was actually a congressional committee that was formed independently. I mean, this was just sort of in the zeitgeist at the moment, called the Nye Commission, which investigated that issue. And they basically found, I think, sort of the answer to what's also going on what has been going on in Afghanistan, was once war was declared, they made a ton of money and they made sure that they were making a ton of money. And they made sure to like, be like, hey, don't you need this weapon system? And don't you need this kind of gun? And don't you need these undershirts? And they were grifting off, they were profiteering off of it. But essentially, saying that DuPont or Remington or whatever, General Electric, that they went to, Woodrow Wilson and were like, we need to invade Europe. Yeah, that's not what happened. Right. Mm-hmm. And, it is. So this is why, this is why I, it's subtler than that. As you know, what Butler gets wrong, or what he sees a little too simplistically, is just how complex these situations are, how many different mouths there are to feed, how many different voices there are. The invasion of Iraq, like alone, there was so many, there were people who were like, we need this to spread democracy. We need this because Saddam Hussein is a bad guy. Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. That was just true. There were people who were like, we need to get in for the oil. There are other people who are like, oh, it's too vulgar to say we need to get in for the oil. It's anytime you try to boil down something as complicated as a war, even as complicated as an individual person like Smedley Butler, into a single explanation, you're always going to trip over yourself. And so, I guess I understand and endorse to a certain extent. First of all, people should read, War as a Racket. They should also read Gangsters of Capitalism, because I think I try to give more complicated answers to why these things happen and other sources, right? That is not a book that on its own will explain everything, but the military industrial complex is a thing, and it is a powerful thing, and it does explain a lot. It doesn't explain everything, but explains a lot. I was the correspondent in Haiti during the 2010 earthquake, and I covered, the international response, which ended up being, just a complete
disaster
cluster. Yeah. Right. And, some people were involved in that to make money. Some of those people were Haitian. Many of those people were, the so-called Beltway bandits, the for-profit, contractors, Dyncorp, Chemonix, you know, who were, you know, pushing their own, but none of them caused the earthquake. You know, so it's, and none of them were solely responsible for what happened. I just think, you know, what I want is, you know, for people to, and this is what I tried to do in writing this book. I'm trying to explain it from multiple points of view, Smedley Butler's point of view, like, you know, the historical consensus point of view, you know, historical revisionist point of view, the points of views of different groups in all of these countries. And in doing that, like, I'm trying to hopefully, like, you know, create a more 3D, really 4D picture, because I'm also moving through time.
Yeah, this is a very useful heuristic that I just, you know, want to emphasize of what you're saying, which is that they're more like vultures than people who are pushing something. And even if they are pushing it, they're not generally the main impetus, but it's more like once you get involved, once the meat is on the street, you know, so to speak, then they just come swooping down and creating that system. So I guess what I'm curious is that, you know, when we see this, there's so much lack of faith, I think rightfully, in the foreign policy establishment, and more. What do you think is a good heuristic for people to have, and thinking about this multifaceted confluence of events, if a future kind of conflict arises, what are the things that people should ask themselves and the reference materials that they should have?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, it's, you know, look, if in 2002, I remember 2002 very well, I was a senior in college. And then I ended up actually reporting from the Pentagon at the outbreak of the Iraq War. As I was a grad student at the time, but I was also reporting for a small newspaper chain called Lee Newspapers. And, you know, if more of this history had been part of the conversation, I think some, you know, who knows, but maybe some different choices could have been made, right? I mean, people who just could have been like, you know, you're saying this is for democracy, you're saying this is for freedom, you're saying this has something to do with 9/11, which it doesn't. You're saying they're weapons of mass destruction, which seems a little suspect. You know, how, you know, what if we look at this in the lens of, you know, these earlier wars, not just, you know, because again, all anybody can ever think about is World War II. If they want a war, then they're just like, you know, Saddam Hussein is Hitler, and not invading will you know be Munich, and to a certain extent, you know, because it's more in living memory, Vietnam, and so that was sort of, it was just sort of like, is this World War II or is it Vietnam? And it was like, it was more Vietnam than World War II, but it was really more, it like Iraq really had much more in common with, you know, the invasion of Haiti in 1915, you know, the invasions of Nicaragua in 1910, 1912. You know,
well, actually, looking, you could even start where you begin and say that Iraq literally had something in common with Cuba. The Maine, because you have this incident.
Exactly.
Unlike with the main, like September 11th was real in terms of the underlying dynamic there.
Yes.
But then that leads to, like, for example, like if you're, cause you're talking at the start of the book about, you know, how, you know, Smedley Butler, he's in Pennsylvania, he's on the main line and they're all talking about this war and you need to avenge this act. None of them were thinking, hey, like what happens if it turns out the Spaniards have this terrible turn of the 1850s fleet that will defeat in a day with basically, actually, this is, this is really morbid, but I always think of like the worst deaths in a war, and the only casualty of that battle was a guy who died of heat stroke on the American side. Just like one specific guy died of heat stroke. But the point is, you had no idea that invading Cuba would then lead to a 46-year occupation of the country.
Right.
No one thought, hey, getting Osama bin Laden or attempting to get him in Afghanistan would lead to Kabul. Yep. 6 months ago. So I think that's just like the, I want to add.
You bring up a really good point. You know, Butler, it's the Maine. that really, you know, that he looks back on as being, you know, one of the things that gets him into that war. Even that, I mean, like, again, you can just drill in forever. Even, you know, even the main incident, sorry, I'm freezing a little bit. Even the main incident, you know, it gets oversimplified. It, you know, it, it seems like, you know, by all accounts, the main was probably, it probably wasn't like literally a false flag. It was probably just like
a terrible accident.
It was a big accident. Yeah, exactly.
The ship was just poorly made. Like the basically like the munitions were next to the boiler. It was a dumb idea. And, you know, and there were other things also that, that led to, you know, the main blows up in February, war is declared in April. And the push to war had already been going on, you know, to a certain extent, it was propaganda, but it was, you know, pushed by the war lobby, pushed by Cuban exiles, but about legitimate things. You know, the Spanish had just invented concentration camps in Cuba. They were doing horrible things. And so, you know, Americans were like, you know, like Spain is bad, and you know, 100
it
you
was
know, whatever
it was. In Cuba,
yeah, and like 200, you know, whatever it was, 262, you know, sailors and Marines really did die on the Maine, and then it just gets, you know, caught up into this war fervor. And you know, 9/11 is sort of similar, like 9/11, an absolutely atrocious, horrible tragedy that ends up being used by the Bush administration to its benefit, which does not then logically lead to the Bush administration did 9/11, but you can sort at all, but you can understand how people would come to that wrong conclusion, because like, if they hadn't had a 9/11, it's almost like, well, they would have had to do something like that, because they ended up using it for their own benefit. And so, yeah. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that I'm saying is it's like, you know, look at history, like look at the ways in which tragedies get used for certain purposes. And then look at, you know, look at all of the times that, you know, people have said, you know, oh, this will be an easy war. We'll be home by Christmas. You know, just set up your picnic blanket and watch it start. Like it's not going to be a big deal. And then 20 years later, you know, and however many, you know, thousands or millions of dead there are, you're like, well, we should have seen this coming. Well, you could have seen it coming if you looked at how this had happened before.
And you're helping me better cement, because once again, it's like not, because we'll hit this in the intro, where we're talking about Smedley Butler, because he was the most decorated Marine in U.S. history. He was a, you know, senatorial candidate. This is a deeply important person in a period of our history that we just don't really focus on for a variety. Like let's just say the industrialization stuff is a little more interesting in terms of history book stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm concerned about his lack. And I did this terrible thing as a reviewer of a book where I read the first 75 pages and the last 50 pages. So maybe I missed something right in the middle, but I'm concerned with his lack of interest in the role of ideas in war. So for example, you said it yourself, Munich, appeasement. Mm-hmm. My interpretation of post-World War II history, and I say this as someone who's cribbing from other people, this is not my original idea, but let me just put it this way. The idea of leaders not wanting to be Neville Chamberlain, of believing that giving in X, Y, and Z situation leads to Hitler rising, has caused more wars than any under-the-counter check from an industrialist ever. And you know, and that's a serious, that has nothing to do with money. It's an actual idea, that if Neville Chamberlain had stood up to Hitler in 1938, the world would be a better place.
Right.
Like you said, this is the problem of treating World War II as everything. Then all of a sudden, and I think Korea is a little more complicated, but Vietnam is all of a sudden World War II. Talking of bombing Iran in the 2000s is World War II. Iraq is World War II, and that's a real problem. So right now,
those drums are beating in Ukraine. You know, people are talking about, you know, Putin and Russia, and you know,
what do you think about Putin and Russia?
Again, not a good guy, not a good country. I am terrified of a war. I think that, you know, going to war in, I don't know what we do, but going to war in Ukraine, you know, could easily lead to World War III. And that would be very bad.
And this is what I want the audience to really get. Like,
anyone who's like, you know, oh, it'll be quick.
But this is the thing though. Like, I don't think anyone. No, I don't. There is no one. And this is like why it's important to have this conversation after 20 years of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
No one is arguing, for good or for ill, that this will be quick.
Right.
And I also think I like the emotional way you described that war, because this is what frustrates me when the audience writes in with the more conspiratorial direction where it's like, actually someone saying that Putin is Hitler, that's such a powerful idea. Mm-hmm. You saying, hey, actually this isn't Hitler. We don't want Vietnam. We don't want 20. Like, those are just really powerful ideas. And let me just ask this quick before I give Sagar the last question, which is what was Smedley's viewpoint just on like ideology? Like, so not as domestic politics, which were kind of progressive Republican-y. Like, how did he think about this type of question?
I mean, so in the same way that, you know, thought since World War II has been influenced almost entirely by World War II, especially, you know, in the 1920s and 1930s, everything was viewed in terms of World War I. Mm-hmm. And Neville Chamberlain as well. I mean, what Neville Chamberlain was trying to do was he was like, there was this, you know, this just meat grinder that just wiped out a generation in every European country, including the UK. And he was just like, I don't want to do that again. And that was why he was greeted, you know, when he came home from the Munich conference.
As a hero.
As a hero. Because Britons were like, you know, let's not do that again. You know, and Butler as well. I mean, Butler goes to, he's in World War One. He gets there sort of late. He's stuck in Haiti. The Wilson administration considers him too important to the occupation of Haiti. But in 1918, he goes to France and gets his first general star and is in charge of a disembarkation, re-embarkation camp in Brest on the far west coast of France. And so he sees, you know, the soldiers getting off the boat. And then he sees the soldiers, far fewer of them and less of them individually, because they're horribly maimed. They're, you know, they're blinded. They have these like gas injuries, and he sees them coming back the other way. And so what he's doing in the 1930s is, you know, he hates Hitler. He calls him a mad dog. He gets court-martialed in 1931 for insulting Benito Mussolini.
Like, tell a story real quick. It's very funny. It's a funny story.
He gives a speech at a club in Philadelphia, where he recounts a story that he had heard from a friend, that the friend was driving through the countryside with Mussolini in his Fiat, and that basically Mussolini runs over a child. And
that wasn't the funny part, to be clear.
The funny part.
More of the circumstances.
And the American friend says to Mussolini, like, you know, I think we hit something back there, something like that. And as Butler recounts it, he says something along the lines of like, you know, what is the life of a child in the history of a great state? Butler, to his credit, and this is me as a journalist giving him full credit, he does not burn his source. His source turns out to be Cornelius Vanderbilt IV, who is not, by the way, the last journalist in the Vanderbilt family. Anderson Cooper,
Anderson Cooper, the most
prominent of those. And Vanderbilt sort of, some other reporters figure this out. They track him down. He denies it at the time, but then in his memoirs is like, okay, yeah, all of that happened.
Which is crazy. Like,
the United States had good relations. The United States was trying to maintain neutrality and had good relations with Mussolini. Like, you know, people
are saying active duty generals shouldn't be giving paid speeches where they have an incentive to troll and get clickbait. Because that's just a quick sidebar here.
Yes.
The thing that's also wild is that this is a book where if you served, like Sagar and I have interest in like defense policy, but if you've like served in the military and you hear how crazy things used to be, he doesn't have a college degree, he becomes an officer, he's giving these speeches, there are movies. It was kind of like, man, like sometimes norms are just good. Like it's like a very cold take, but man, like we need rules.
One thing, Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
The funny footnote to that is that to represent him in the court martial, Butler asks his friend Henry Leonard, who has one arm, because they had fought together in China during the Boxer Rebellion. And his friend Harry had rescued Butler after Butler got shot and got shot in the arm and ended up losing the arm. The reason why Leonard and Butler both got shot was because they were led into the Battle of Tianjin by a doughy engineer named Herbert Hoover, who at the time of this court martial happens to be president of the United States. So Butler gets his friend who lost his arm because Herbert Hoover screwed up and took them to the wrong place on the battlefield to defend him against the Hoover administration and gets him off. And most importantly, makes it so Butler does not have to apologize to Mussolini. And Butler had a big point there. His point was, you know, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, fascism and Butler and you know, politics in the 1930s. Butler's point in telling that story, he doesn't tell it just sort of as like a shocking story. Mussolini at that time is trying to position himself as kind of a reasonable moderate. He's trying to say like, we just don't want another war and we should all disarm at the same time that, you know, he's clearly like,
he's about to invade Ethiopia.
Ethiopia, exactly. And Butler is saying correctly, like, you can't trust this guy. Like, fascists are killers. They're duplicitous. They'll say anything. Don't believe him. And saying that as an active duty officer is what ends up getting him court-martialed, and then he ends up getting off.
The best thing that ever happened for Norms is when Truman fired Douglas MacArthur. But really enjoy talking to you. And the book is fascinating. I think this is very useful to people. Whenever you hear people bring up War as a Racket, most of the time I haven't read it. They like the term and like to throw it around. So this is, I think, a very, very good analytical framework, your book, and this episode in particular. So we'll have a link down there in the description, and we appreciate you joining us, man. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.